Hello.
Hello.
Welcome, Sophie, to Untalented.
Thank you very much for having me.
You're so welcome. So what we usually do is a little this or that exercise, just to, you know, break the ice a bit. It's funny, I actually asked ChatGPT, because we usually do some like very basic pop culture ones. I thought it would be fun if we did like an advertising specific this or that. Asked ChatGPT and they were so dry. They were like mobile first campaigns or desktop campaigns. I was like, no, let's just stick with pop culture.
Let's do that, yeah.
Okay, so pizza or pasta? I think that's
pasta.
That's
really hard.
It's hard.
To be honest.
Also, both of which you have when you're feeling a certain way.
I don't know. Yeah, it's probably pizza, really. I don't know.
Nice. Morning or evening?
Morning.
This one's a bit random. Paris or Nicole?
Paris.
Instagram or TikTok?
Oof. I mean, I use Insta more, but I get lost in TikTok regularly, so
yeah,
hard to say.
Me too. Yeah. The algorithm knows.
Yeah.
Film or TV?
Film.
Introvert or extrovert?
I'll say introvert. People will laugh at that.
Really? Cats or dogs?
Cats.
Really? Interesting. It's funny when you think someone's a dog person, but then you get it wrong. Nature or city?
Nature.
80s or 90s music?
80s.
Crunchy or smooth peanut butter?
Oh, crunchy.
Apparently that's a real crowd breaker, that one.
Smooth. Oh, can't stand this. Yeah.
Nike or Adidas?
Nike. Which is funny. I'm wearing Adidas today. But normally I'd have said Adidas, yeah. Well, yeah, tricky.
It depends if you're like thinking about the brand or what you are personally drawn to, I guess. Flats or heels?
A flat.
I kind of knew that. Nights in or nights out?
In.
The Office or Friends?
The Office.
Yeah, got to be. Cool, that was that. Just nice little exercise.
Yeah.
What we usually do is we like to ask our guests who the first person is that made them feel talented in every single episode. Mm. And I feel we've spoken about this before and it's kind of went around an interesting sort of loop.
Gosh. I mean, I think I was thinking about this on the way here. I think that there were two people who were a team, a partnership, not a creative team, but a partnership, Jim Carroll and Gwyn Jones at BBH. And I was trying to work out why they thought I was talented. I can't really, you know, it's where you think, why did they decide that I was good? And I've got no idea why, actually, because I didn't really work with them at the beginning of BBH. So this was years and years ago, 1999, something like that. But they were, it's very hard to put my finger on why they thought I was any good, but they seemed to. So I sort of took that.
Did they tell you?
Did they tell me? I don't know. I don't know that. I mean, definitely people at BBH told me. So there were people like Charlie Rudd, who was my boss at the time, who's now running the whole of Publicist, basically, who told me. And I was an account manager at the time, and so he did. And people gave me feedback and said nice things, and always said, "Oh, you wear your heart on your sleeve too much," which still continues to be the feedback I have today.
I think that's like it's kind of a blessing and a curse.
can be good, can be terrible.
Yeah.
I don't know. I'm not sure Gwyn and Jim ever said, "Oh, you're good," but the way they behaved towards me just. I don't know, BBH is a place I think that you either sort of love or hate, and it just filled me with confidence, I guess. And maybe I didn't know that at the time, that's the other thing. When I look back, I don't know really that I knew how great a sort of situation that was. It's only really with the benefit of hindsight you realise that not all places are like that.
Yeah.
But no, I just guess... I guess I was given lots of encouragement in a sort of, discernible but not sort of totally expressed yeah. way, I guess. I don't know.
Yeah, that's true. And I guess where it's a feeling recognised by somebody else is probably why it's quite a hard question to answer, because it's not something which you remember yourself. It's a you know, a bit of potential which someone else saw in you.
Yeah. I was thinking about this a bit as well. I think there were definitely places, and BBH was one of them, and maybe still, who sort of saw that I was perhaps a tiny bit ambivalent towards advertising. Mm. And I think some places are drawn to that.
Yeah.
And some places aren't. Some places want you to be sort of all in, and yeah. advertising is everything, and nothing can be more important than advertising. And some places like the fact, and I gravitate towards people who have other things going on,
yeah.
or who say, you know, I'm doing this other thing, or I'm interested in this other thing. I often find it quite sort of challenging when people say, oh, I've loved advertising since I was a four-year-old, and I'm, you know, yeah. I saw ads and I just desperately wanted to be in advertising. And I always think, oh, that's quite weird. And I don't really understand it, because I tend to think the best people in advertising actually have lots of other things
yeah.
going on.
Yeah.
You know, their interests aren't advertising, their interests
yeah.
are
yeah.
culture and the world, and they bring those things to bear. So yeah, sorry, that was a rambling answer to the who made me sort of feel talented. And yeah, Gwyn and Jim yeah. were the people who made me feel talented. And BBH yeah. made me feel talented.
So I remember we were talking about it, and it was less about that one specific person and actually more so about an environment which has been cultivated to make people
yeah.
feel like they have potential, you know, and make people
yeah. I mean, it was
thrive.
Just, and it was just so, you, it was, you know, I think the thing for me probably that made me feel that way was that your opinion wasn't just asked for, it was demanded. So if you didn't have an opinion, then what were you doing
yeah.
there? You know,
yeah.
you weren't there. And I was an account person at the time, and in lots of agencies, you know, that role is a sort of client smoothing
yeah. Yeah.
management. It's a very skillful role, but it wasn't one, actually, it turns out, that I was that interested yeah. in all or really any good at. What I loved was strategy
yeah.
and the work. And those two things were the things that BBH seemed to want me to have an opinion
yeah.
on. Well, they wanted everyone to have an opinion on
yeah.
it. You know, it really was a at that time, so the very end of, you know, 1999 onwards, beginning of the 2000s, it was all about, it didn't seem to me at all to be about people's egos mm. and individuals. It seemed to me about the collective desire to make great work. That seemed very obvious to me,
yeah.
Which I just, you know, I loved.
Yeah. yeah. As an account person, when did the penny drop that you were like, okay, I'm actually not very good at this and I really want to do strategy?
I mean, it should have dropped a lot sooner than it did. I will always say to people I'm a slow starter, so I'm always a sort of tortoise probably in the scheme of things. People always want to go faster and I'm always the person saying, hang on a minute, slow down. But there were specific moments. I can remember being on a shoot in Argentina with quite a difficult client. And at that point I thought, God, this is, you know, this is just terrible. What
yeah.
am I doing? What is this?
Mm.
But I knew there was something that I loved, but I just knew I hated all the things that account management really you need to be good
yeah.
at. I hated sort of negotiations. I hated talking about money. I hated sort of that idea that I had to be a sort of someone who was going to think about the client. I mean, the client's wants and needs. I think about those things, but I think about them strategically.
In a different way.
Yeah. I don't think about them in the sort of,
yeah.
you know, is it their birthday or what are they interested in or have they got a dog? I think about, okay,
solution
what's
focus.
The right thing for the
yeah.
brand?
Yeah.
And I just couldn't. I was just, you know, hopeless at all those sorts of things.
Yeah.
And also I'm a sort of, you know, planners often, I mean, everybody jokes in planning about planners being a bit sort of awkward and often introverted. Actually, lots of people will say I'm not an introvert, but I would probably dispute that. But, you know, I don't think of myself as a sort of charming person or a person who's very much at ease. I hate going into rooms of people which I don't know, and you know, the networking word just fills me with just,
slightly soul destroying.
Oh, terrible! But people are really skillful at it. Don't get me wrong. I don't think it's skill, but it's not one that I have. Yeah. And I think those things are really, really important for brilliant account people. And I just wasn't good at them. And the bit I loved, like I said, I sort of probably encroached. BBH was great again because it allowed you to encroach upon strategy.
Yeah.
And they wanted their account people to be strategic. But being an account person just wasn't right.
It's an interesting segue though, isn't it? Because it's sort of like, does anybody know they want to be a strategist?
Yeah, it's a difficult one. I mean, it comes back around to that probably, and we'll come onto it later, you know, talent and how you find people.
Yeah.
Because even knowing, you know, what jobs exist, frankly, in advertising, if you're not a very driven person sort of at uni, basically the old model was you're a very driven person at university, you find out there's the milk round, you sort of think advertising might be interesting, and then you go through a process of what used to be grueling sort of week-long sort of, you know, made up situations in which you're put through your paces and evaluated and whatever, and you make it or you don't make it. And who knew there was a job that was about thinking about strategic direction? You know, I didn't know that. I went to a state school and went to university, but I was a very sort of unproactive, you know, sort of university exiter. I sort of said to people, maybe I'll go into publishing just because I've done a degree in English. And I thought, that sounds okay. So, I mean, I just didn't really know. And to your point, I don't think people really know. Some agencies take on planners in their, you know, what used to be graduate recruitment now is sort of just recruitment at the bottom level. But yes, I think it's something you sort of do have to unearth a bit for yourself. It's not a thing I think that is particularly well known. Yeah. But it does seem to sort of attract a certain type of a person, I suppose.
Definitely.
I don't mean background wise, personality.
But it's interesting. It's such a specific skill set that I think a lot of people, as you say, don't know they would be good at it or they have an interest in it, because there's not really many kind of normal job environments that kind of pull out those skills.
No, and also I think, you know, I think one of the reasons, back to BBH, I started at an agency actually called Duckworth Fingrub Waters, which doesn't exist anymore, and that was just a fantastic place to start. Again, very, very strategic.
Yeah.
It was a little office in Great Pulteney Street, and Finn, who was Finn of Duckworth Finn, used to go off and have lunch regularly at the Ivy. So that was the sort of time.
Oh, wow. Wow.
And you used to sort of roam a bit around the office, and occasionally you'd say, do you want to come to lunch? And you'd go off to the Ivy and listen to Finn's stories. And your payment for listening to Finn's stories would be lunch at the Ivy.
Listening tax.
So you can tell how long ago that was.
Wow.
I mean, at the Ivy as well, classic. But I think, you know, it's a very much an on-the-job.
Yeah.
You know, you really discover how to do it. I still think it's an incredibly practical job. It's quite, you know, it's interesting to me. There are quite a lot of people out there who are sort of famous, in inverted commas, planners, such that you can be a famous planner or strategist.
You're a famous planner.
No, totally not. But people who have very high profile talk a lot about planning in the press and about strategy and I always think to myself, I'm a practical planner. What I like is strategy. Mm. I like doing it. And I think you keep doing it probably.
Yeah.
You know, I think it's funny that you sort of, as you move up, you don't really do a different job. You do the same job.
Yeah.
It is a funny one. Yeah, I was very slow probably to get to planning. I was probably quite stubborn as well. Maybe I thought there was more. I don't know.
Well,
I don't,
you'd rather wait and get it right.
Yeah, maybe. And I don't know. Maybe I just didn't think that anyone would particularly have me in a way as a planner. Oh. You know, who knows, you don't know.
Yeah.
And then, yeah, as I mentioned before, I think to you, I was working with a brilliant planner called Rachel Hatton, who runs strategy at Oliver now. And we were working on Flora, very glamorous yellow fats.
Mm-hmm.
And she was running the BBH department at the time, and she just wrote this brilliant strategy about heart health for Flora. It was just brilliant. I remember listening to her and watching her and thinking, God, that's so good. I want to be doing that. And some planners had left BBH, and I said, I think I sent her an email in a sort of silly way. I didn't say it to her, but probably scared, and said, you know, are you looking for any enthusiastic but underqualified planners? And she said yes, and so I was about and when she said yes, I think I just thought that's right and so yes, I was about to go into strategy at BBH, and instead I went and joined Mother and became a strategist there, because it seemed like a sort of easier. You know, you didn't have that baggage around how people perceived you, I guess, was my thinking at the time. Who knows? I mean, I was however old. Can't remember. But yeah, I went off to Mother.
Nice. Yeah. I was really keen to talk about when you were talking about Finn and the Ivy, because we'll go on to discuss some of your iconic campaigns you've been behind, particularly the Body Form, the Here Come the Girls, all of which are very much kind of through that of a kind of feminist lens.
Yeah.
But I imagine... I'm just thinking about Mad Men right now, and I'm just thinking about, there must have been some challenges between then and now to create the work that you did.
Yeah.
What did that look like? Did you experience any?
I mean, I think, I don't know. I think I'm very lucky in a way, in that I don't think I can identify any specific situations in which I felt threatened in the context of my working life by a man. And I say very lucky, because I'm pretty much everyone I know.
Yeah, it's crazy that makes you lucky, right?
Yeah, yes. Like, number one, the fact that I consider myself lucky. Number two, insane. The fact that everyone else I know has found themselves in that situation. I think probably... to the introvert extrovert point, I was perceived as quite a sort of loud person. I have a loud voice, and I think there was probably some fear, if I'm really honest, that loud voice would persist if people behaved inappropriately towards me. But undoubtedly, I have, and that's about a threat or a feeling of fear. I have undoubtedly been in many, 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 many situations in which clients, agency people didn't talk directly to me,
really,
even though I was the person with whom they should be having the conversation, because I was the person who had, for example, presented a strategy, and they would talk to a man in the room.
Wow.
So, you know, and that was quite relatively frequent and can still happen. I mean, not that long ago, I think that happened to me, and I thought, this is very bizarre, because I've just presented work to you, and you're now looking across the table and having the conversations about the work.
How did that make you feel?
I mean, it's a crazy thing, but it's also the reality of, I mean, I still am amazed. I'm amazed at the number of CEOs.
Just leadership.
And leadership in general, who are male.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, I just find it incredible. Yeah. And I find it incredible in relation to the brands and the companies that I work with over and over again.
Yeah.
Not least because there's sort of this idea that they are only men, I think, can be serious business people and can really understand the business end of things. And I just find that just bonkers. And I find it bonkers because what we do in advertising, and for most of our clients, some of them have complex business models, that's true.
Yeah.
Not that women can't understand complex business models, you understand, but most of them have very simple business models, which is they make things and they sell things. Yeah. And they try to sell them for more than they than it costs to make them. And that, as far as I'm concerned, is pretty straightforward.
Yeah.
And most of them need understanding of the people that they are trying to sell them to in order to be able to make them sell more or sell better or whatever.
Yeah.
And so it just, you know, I am a, I mean, some people find the feminist word, I don't know, they're uneasy with it. I'm not uneasy with it. I am a feminist and I find advertising still to be pretty sexist.
Agreed.
And pretty old-fashioned, if I'm really honest. And and the business world in general, you know, it goes further than advertising. I think what happens in agencies is they're still a agencies largely are still a reflection of the clients that they seek to serve. And what that means is, you know, people sort of go, oh, well, it's got to be a man because he's got to talk to, you know, CMO, male CMO or CEO or CFO or whoever the relationship is with.
Which is why I think you have, and we can kind of go on to talk about this later in terms of the future of strategy and creative, but you have these small creative shops actually working with forward thinking, purpose, progressive brands.
Yeah.
And that's why it's breaking up.
Yeah. Yeah. And I think also the sort of old model of advertising and the holding companies, I think, are, well, all of them in the midst of transformation. Yeah. And they have to be. That's because they have to be, right? Yeah. Because the world is changing and those huge companies, you know, the clients that we're seeking to serve are changing themselves. And so they have to change. And so I think that big waiting on sort of, you know, big senior, very senior boardroom relationships, which, let's be honest, you know, they happen all the time, right?
The word boardroom just makes me cringe.
I know, it's hideous.
It's horrible.
It's absolutely hideous. And immediately, it's really interesting, isn't it? Because you say the word boardroom and what immediately comes into your head, I don't know about you, but what immediately comes into my head is a room full of men in suits.
Yeah, 100%.
And
mainly all white.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, sorry, that I should have said that. So I think the world is being forced to change, which I really do see as a good thing. But it's incredibly slow. Mm-hmm. I mean, you know, the number of, I love the fact that the number of FTSE 100 female CEOs is like counted, you know, by ones. Yeah, it's like, oh, now there are four instead of three, or, oh, no, one of them's gone, so now there are three. You know, it's crazy. And the thing about you're more likely to be called John and whatever, than it seems to me in the modern world, it is ridiculous. Yeah. And I think it's also caught up with, everything is caught up with, all of this is, and people will sigh and roll their eyes at this, but I think you have to differentiate between men and the patriarchy. Mm. And I'm very clear, the patriarchy is a system. Mm-hmm. And it is a system that needs to change.
Agreed.
Because it doesn't serve modern society.
Yeah.
And that's just a fact. And it's caught up in the way we work and the hours we work and where we work and who does the work and how we're paid. And, you know, everything about it is it sort of structures our society.
Totally. Pay is an interesting one. And again, we can talk about this later on, but that whole...
Sorry, I've just gone...
No, absolutely fine. All good. All good. It's like 2 hours later, we're rambling on about the patriarchy.
Yeah, and back to
it's funny how still, and we see this a lot in terms of like our candidates and who we're representing, but there is still so much nervousness around women asking for a higher salary, like not being able to, feeling that they can't demonstrate their worth.
And I, you know, and it's proven, isn't it? Women think that they can't. Women always think they can't and men always think they can.
Totally.
And so that's always expressed. And I think that I've seen that reflected. Absolutely. I've done a couple of jobs where I clearly should have been doing a job, a role, and I should have been given a title and it should have been given to me.
Yeah.
And there were all these conversations about, oh, well, you've got to, you know, you've got to do this and that before
prove yourself,
and you've got to, and not only have you got to prove yourself, but you've got to maneuver everyone around you so that they're happy with you taking that role. Mm-hmm. And it's just horseshit.
Yeah, it's absolute.
Am I allowed to say?
Yeah, it's absolute horseshit.
And it is because women are not confident. They're not sure of themselves. I think it's a lot to do with, I think it's stylistic as well. And I don't think it's about, oh, women have to lean in and be more. I hate all that as well. Yeah. I hate that whole lean in thing, because for me, it's systemic. It has to be about fundamentally changing the way we see work and the way we see success and the way we see growth coming and the way we see people behaving. But I think it's got to be about, yeah, really thinking carefully about what will get the best results. And so, yeah, it's a, I mean, God, there's a lot to do.
It's a societal problem, isn't it?
It's a huge societal problem, but I think it's very acute probably in a couple of industries. Yeah. Law is probably another one, and advertising is, you know, it's moving, but it's not moving that fast.
Agreed. Really keen to talk about some of your work that you've done before.
Yeah.
Particularly the body form piece.
Yeah, I mean, I can't, love. It's a, yeah, and I can't claim, you know, the incredible, I just saw Margot Revel, who's was the strategy director at AMV, has just left AMV, actually.
Yeah.
I don't know what she's going to do, but something amazing, no doubt.
Was she on the campaign?
So I worked on the first sort of, so I inherited body form. I came back to work after maternity leave at AMV. And previously, I'd spent a lot of time working on Sainsbury's, and I'd done a bit of Mars and Walkers. And I came back after having twins and
no biggie.
Having twins. It was a relief. I can remember coming back and I was like that. I had no sleep and I couldn't really breathe properly and I see anything. I was just like,
And have children, they say.
Yeah, and I, you know, and I got on the train and I could, you know, have a wee in peace and drink a cup of coffee and all those things. So it was sort of a luxury. My husband stayed at home with the then 1 year old twins, which, I mean, that was bonkers in itself. Went back to work and AMV said, oh yeah, we're gonna put you on body form, Libres as it was called around Europe then. And it was a bit of a sort of, I hate to say this, but it was a little bit of a, I mean, and they were being kind, Craig and Bridge, but I think it was a bit of a sort of, oh, here you are, you know, sort of get back into it gently type of a thing. And there was already this strategy, and I thought, well, okay, yeah, Sanpro. I don't know what we even call it anymore. I don't know, period products? I don't know. Anyway, there's a better title than Sanpro, probably period products or something. Feminine hygiene, that's horrible as well. Oh, I don't know what that's all for. I don't even know what the category is.
So clinical,
called.
Isn't it?
Yeah, it's like feminine hygiene. Yeah, like, it's no, also like you need special hygiene as well. It's another one of those.
Well, this is it. We're just made to feel like
terrible dividers. I thought, all right, yeah, that's good. Never worked on that before. And actually, I met the client early on and she said, she's German, the senior client, and she said, oh, I can remember. She said, oh, let's go to Pret, and we went for a coffee around the corner, and she said, oh, I'm very direct, and I always get on quite well with Germans, so quite direct, and I just say what I think, and I was like, well, that's brilliant, because that's pretty direct, and I say what I think, so it's going to be great. But the strategy was already fixed. Bridget actually had, I can't remember, with another planner, had worked on the pitch, and the strategy was all this, it was all about living fearless. And the advertising, Bridge won't mind me saying this, but I mean, and I worked on some of it. It was terrible. They'd done this thing and they sort of gone, oh, it's first, but they had made some strides because they'd gone, oh, it's first person sort of POV. So it was like women doing stuff and then you'd see them in a bathroom and they'd take their underwear down. And I think you'd even see that. I mean, this sounds ridiculous now. Mm. I think you'd even see the sanitary product putting it in their knickers because Libres didn't make tampons. It was all about pads. And that was quite, I think that was quite a big deal at the time. But the ads was, I mean, the one I worked on, and it went on for ages, was this one about a woman, POV, a trapeze artist. Oh my God, it's bad.
Oh, wow.
I mean, and the client were very happy, so sorry, Martina, if she ever listens to this, which I doubt she will.
So
she went on to, well, much headier things. So she won't be worried. But it was a trapeze artist, and out she went and did her and this was all POV, and then she went into the loo and did her whatever, and it was all about Live Fearless. And I was a bit like, oh, Live Fearless, what are we going to do with that? That's like, oh. But then, and I often think this happens this way, they came to us and it was the time of Like a Girl, and brands were female brands, women brands, Dove and things. They were starting to do things which weren't terrible. So they were starting to break out of sort of, you know, roller skating on beaches and things. And the dialogue around women was really starting to happen.
What do you think was the reason why?
Well, I can't remember the sort of chronology, but the Harvey Weinstein thing was kicking around.
Yeah.
Perhaps that was a bit later, but it was
there
probably. And things were really, I don't know. It was just, it was all in the timing. It was just, I think the world was ready for the dialogue around women finally to change.
Yeah.
You know, hormones and periods and later menopause and fertility, you know, those things were there, and yet they were still sort of advertised in the most kind of, you know, just nonsense way. And were still incredible sort of taboos societally. And I think, I don't know, I just think it was, I always think these things are kind of timing. And yeah, so that sort of thing was dialogue around women was happening, and they gave us this little, it was described as a little brief, you know, it wasn't little at all, but it was about making the brief was to make Live Fearless famous, this idea of Live Fearless. And we were like, oh god, and they sort of wanted a, you know, can we have a Like a Girl or something like that. And I was working on it with a planner called Pippa Morris, who now works at Revolt, I think. And she was really good. Yeah. She's great. Yeah. And I think we wrote a half page brief. I think it was me and her. And there was actually a business director at the time called James Drummond, who's now at Uncommon, I think. And we wrote this half page brief, and we got this team, and they were called Diego and Caio. And very sadly, one of them is no longer with us. But they were just this most brilliant team, Brazilian, and we briefed them to talk about, to do something to try and drive fame around Live Fearless. And I can remember having this conversation where they said, you know, does it have to be about periods? And we said, because there was a lot that was going on that was kind of CSR and sustainability, and could it be a sort of adjacent thing, a laterally related thing to periods or to women. We said, no, it's got to be about periods. And they went away, and we talked about quite a lot. There was quite a lot of conversation, which at the time felt quite awkward, even with Diego and Caio, both of whom had girlfriends or wives at the time. And we talked about periods and how different they were for people, and how, you know, what happened, literally what you felt like every month, and that sort of feeling of, I don't know, everything about periods. And it was a very sort of unusual conversation, I suppose, to have at work at the time. And also it definitely was Live Fearless. It wasn't just me who thought the work was rubbish. At AMV at the time, it was just a complete sort of hospital pass. Yeah. Nobody wanted to work on it. It was a very, very male creative floor. And I think the creative directors were a team called Toby and Jim. Toby's now at the AM Partnership. He's the chief creative officer. And they were the creative directors, and Diego and Kai working into them. And yeah, nobody wanted to really touch it. We said, yeah, it's got to be about periods. And so they went away, and they came back, and they said, we think there's something about women and periods and fitness, and we want to make a platform called Red Fit, which is all about how women continue to do exercise when they have their periods.
Yeah.
So somehow they had unearthed this idea that when you get your period, exercise and sort of sport kind of slightly fall out of the window.
I'm just horizontal on the sofa.
Yeah, because you want to, you know, because we'd obviously talked about the fact that, you know, you're doing whatever you're doing and then it gets to your period or pre-period when you feel like, you know, you want to, I don't know.
Yeah.
Just rage at the world, and then you get your period and you want to sit there and whatever, or eat chocolate, and then you want to sit there, lie there and sort of feel slightly sorry for yourself and get over the pain or whatever. And so they came up with this idea about this platform, and with it they had written this amazing film which was all about women doing incredible sporting things and ballet and, oh God, running and all sorts of things. And there was going to be this final scene, and it was all about the fact that no blood would hold us back. So we could bleed every month and we would still carry on doing extraordinary things. And it was absolutely, and I just thought, oh my God, this is brilliant.
It's really refreshing that came from...
I mean, I can remember seeing it, I can remember seeing the idea, and I'm not sure we had that long before the client meeting, and I can remember the room we were in when we presented it, and we presented it as a platform. We were going to do it was going to be a app or a website in the days when everything was an app. I mean, it still is, but in those days it really was like, oh God, was it got to be an app or, you know, because then you had to actually drive people to an app. But it was going to be an app about the what actually happens when you menstruate and the parts of the cycle. And we did a relationship with one of the universities, and again research into periods at that point and the effect of them on, I don't know, women's performance, for example. Was just zip. There was nothing.
It's interesting how there's such a lack of research around your hormones and how they change through your period, pre your period, and then what you're capable of doing, like in the gym, out the gym, what, like your energy levels.
Yeah. Oh, it's incredible.
No one knows about it.
Yeah. And also, I mean, I can remember finding out that actually when you have your period, so when it arrives, you have less estrogen in your body and more testosterone. And so actually your ability to deliver from an aerobic point of view and a strength point of view is increased. And so all those phases, I can't remember what they're all called, but it was going to be a whole program of work and blah, blah, blah. But they made this anyway. Ultimately, it became, we did some work and we did some kind of diet stuff and sports stuff. It was one of those things that later actually Nike did a version of it, and which was miles better. And it was timely, you know, it was the point at which everybody went, oh yeah, I want an app that helps me train and whatever. We were a bit, slightly, the platform itself, I would have said, was a bit before its time. But whatever, what happened was they made this incredible film and the line on it was, no blood will hold us back. And the most exciting thing for me, almost, was that the end shot of this film was supposed to be a woman with menstrual blood running down her leg. And this would have been the first time that menstrual blood was, you know, shown in any sort of context. I think the film was originally going to be shown in Sweden or somewhere, because the Swedes have quite a forward-facing attitude towards. So we worked globally with Essity. And anyway, the directors came on board, Brazilian directors called Jones and Tino, and they decide, weirdly, the client and the director, very rarely happens that way, both decided that they didn't want to put in this final shot of the menstrual blood.
And that's interesting.
Yeah, and I still feel sad about that. I still wish that it had happened. Anyway,
I wonder if this were to happen now.
It would. No, I mean,
they'd have to.
everything is different now. Yeah. And, you know, I guess what was most exciting about that film was that it paved the way, I think, really, I mean, must have left relatively shortly after that. I went to an agency called Iris, and I guess
one of the best. It's so good.
And I guess Margot then came and took over and made the most, you know, and has the most incredible, you know, body of work. Yeah. I think, you know, Essity Bodyform have done, you know, just incredible things. And it's obviously to do with the AMV team and the client team as well. Who have just been extraordinary. So, I'm very proud of that, because I guess I'd say it sort of was the very tiny start point of something that went on to become, you know, sort of culture changing, I suppose.
And within that, obviously, you know, it sounded like there was a real creative, collaborative vibe with the creative team.
Yeah, they were
brilliant.
What
would you say is the recipe behind the best creative work?
I mean, there are probably some creatives who'll really laugh at this or just be horrified by it, but who I've probably worked with before. But for me, it's always closeness.
Yeah.
I mean, I don't really think that any of the work that I've really been proud of, most proud of, has come from anything other than just very, very, and also not just, it's, you know, everybody talks about baton passing and you write brief and you put it in. I don't really like those relationships. Yeah. I'm not interested in them. I love what creative people can do. They can do what I can't do and they can bring magic to something. Mm. But I love trying to keep feeding things in and feeding and feeding and feeding and feeding, you know, probably to the point where they'll tell me to shove it. But the closeness of relationships for me is the thing that has always brought about the best work.
Yeah.
And creatives who you can have, you know, robust but constructive conversations with, who are open to listening to things that you might, I mean, I spend all my time going, oh, what about this? Have you seen this? What about that? Oh, I saw this thing, which can drive some people wild. But I love creative people and I love talking to them and I love listening to them and I love hearing their embryonic ideas. I love it most when teams come along and they go, oh, I've had this thought, I've had this, what about this? Yeah. Or I've seen this thing, or that's what I find most exciting in general. And so, yeah, I think with all the things I'm most proud of, it's been with a team or a person with whom I've had that kind of relationship.
And it's interesting because now we're seeing strategy and creative as a pair, their own kind of creative team.
Yeah, it's really interesting. Somebody moved recently,
Droga
didn't
Five.
They? I don't know either of those. It's Shelley and Damien. Yeah. I don't know them, but do you know what? That doesn't surprise me at all. And I'm, in a way, I'm surprised it hasn't happened sooner.
Agreed.
And yeah, I mean, I think to find those, that type of relationship, and to know that way of working. I think when you work with creative people and you work with them a lot, you do have a shorthand. You have you know what they want from you, you know what they need from you, and you know the kind of things that they'll really respond well to. So, yeah, I think it's brilliant. I hope it sort of paves the way for more kind of, I don't know, pairings, I suppose, in a way, and to have that kind of closeness, because I think it's really, well, I just think it will bring the best
work. It's so valuable.
Yeah.
It's so valuable.
I can't see a point at which it doesn't help make the work better, I suppose. Good. So, yeah, I think it's great.
Great. Love that. I wanted to talk a bit about kind of the impact that you hope to have on brands and kind of what that looks like. Yeah. And I was more particularly interested in being a mother of two, does your, I guess, vision and impact that you hope to achieve shift quite significantly? And how did that transition look for you?
Yeah, I mean, I don't know that it changed, although I'm very acutely aware of sort of how sort of squashy the minds of two 10-year-olds are and how much they absorb. I suppose I've always tried, and this is a weird word in advertising, I know, but I've always tried to help my clients to be truthful about what it is that their products do. Mm. And that's a slightly weird concept in advertising.
Interesting.
I'm very much of the school of thought that you can't and shouldn't try to pull the wool over people's eyes. I find debates around things like sugar and advertising quite tricky, because I think if you're an advertiser or an agency, you can't have it both ways.
Yeah.
Either advertising works or it doesn't.
Yeah.
And if it does work, then, which I believe it does, then you have to accept the fact that restrictions on advertising in relation to sugar and products which cause obesity need to be put in place. Yeah. So I'm probably contrary to a lot of people, but I think you have to try to get to honesty. I would also say that, you know, one of the things that troubles me most is what I see as, you know, the sort of pervasive influence of social media.
Yeah.
And I see that, well, I see that in both my children. I have a boy and a girl, but I worry most about my daughter because, again, back everything comes back to feminism, doesn't it? Sorry.
I love it. I love it.
But I see, you know, I can see her do things and respond to things in a way that show me that she is seeing things that put forward a totally unrealistic view of women in the world.
It's terrifying. And I'm not sure if I can say this, but I would be fucked if I was a teenager growing up now. Oh. I genuinely would be completely fucked.
Yeah. I would no doubt be unemployed, but apart from anything else. But I think it is, it's a very, very, it's a very, very tricky space to navigate. Yeah. And I suppose I think, as I say, I try to think about, with brands as much as anything else, think about ways to sort of be truthful about what we're selling and what they do and don't do.
Yeah.
So I often, you know, I often gravitate towards strategies that are, you know, maybe slightly flippant almost in relation to products, things like, I don't know, silly things like Tango or Oasis or whatever, where they're saying, you know, we've got budgets and it's hot, have a drink. To me, at least there is a degree of honesty going on in that, and we're not pretending that those things are going to transform you or turn you into something extraordinary. I also think there's probably a bigger, I don't know, I suppose, macro debate about the nature of growth and what growth looks like in the modern world. And that's, you know, really hard to get into. But the fact that businesses have to grow year on year and make more and more and more money, I do think we're starting to see a pushback in that from a societal point of view, and what the concept of less rather than more will mean in society as a whole.
Yeah.
And I think that's a really big, you know, it pertains to the environment, and it pertains to the way people live. And I mean, it pertains to basically everything, but the way businesses run and the demands on them and the demands of shareholders, I think, is a thing that probably will have to undergo some rethinking. So I don't think that's really answered your question, but I think the idea of, I suppose I try to make sure that clients aren't trying to influence people in ways that are damaging to them. And that's a difficult thing,
what
right?
Brands?
Because one can argue that all sorts of brands
can
cause damage in one way or another. Yeah.
Are there any brands that you think are really paving the way and doing a lot of really meaningful work?
I think brands that are about restraint, I mean, you know, and sort of less. So I think that, you know, it's really interesting to me that brands like Vinted are now, what an incredible brand. I think that's fascinating, and the effect that that will have, the knock-on effect on the world that
huge.
Will have, I think, is really, really interesting. And of course, there are the usuals who are really trying to sort of pull back. But I think it will be most interesting to look at the giants, the absolute, you know, McDonald's, Coca-Colas of the world, and start to see the change in those. Yeah. Because they are huge, huge challenges. And I don't know, I see that as sort of exciting.
Yeah.
Difficult. Really, really difficult.
Yeah.
But really exciting.
How can those brands positively impact culture? I know that's such a big question.
Well, I think they, you know, you've got to look at yourself in the round. I think in the end it's got to be about what you're selling to people at the highest level. And if that is the gradual switch from beef to, I mean, you know, I'm sure people at McDonald's are going, oh, don't be so bloody ridiculous, we're never not going to sell hamburgers. But I think those things will have to happen ultimately. I think that change, same way all cars will become electric, yeah. same way I think fossil fuel companies will have to turn themselves into something else. I think that ultimately is about what you are offering into the world. And whilst that may sound unlikely at this point in time, I think, and probably won't happen in my lifetime, I think it's going to have to happen.
I really want to talk a bit about young strategists getting into the industry. But before we do that, I want to ask you what one piece of advice you would give your younger self? Young Sophie, she's in accounts. What piece of advice would you give her?
I'd like it to be something really deep and meaningful, but probably be about haircuts, some dodgy haircuts I've had along the way, no. I think, I don't know, I think it's a funny one. I probably went in, back to the BBH point, quite fearless in advertising. And I think I would probably say, really try to hold on to that more.
Yeah.
Because, I don't know. I think I always sort of tried to say I wasn't scared of anything in advertising. Certainly never be scared of you know, what you sort of dumb down and say, oh, they're stupid questions. They're usually not stupid questions. You know, they're not really.
Yeah.
But you sort of say that they are.
Yeah. Again, that's a female thing. You have to kind of disclaim.
Yeah.
Before
always,
you ask
always
it.
The disclaimers. Yeah. And always the, oh.
Yeah.
Oh,
I don't want to sound silly, but is it okay if
can I just ask you this way? Because if I don't, you might be threatened. And...
Classic.
So, yeah, probably just go for it.
Yeah. Nice.
Don't waste as much time. I mean, again, some people will laugh at this because they wouldn't think of me as a pussyfooting around, but I think probably less of that, even less.
And what's one thing, I feel like I probably know the answer to this already, but what's one thing you would change about the industry?
If I could be very, very specific... I think I would probably change I don't think I can be very specific because there's so much, but I think probably the boardrooms,
yeah. They gotta go.
Yeah.
They gotta go.
They gotta be called something else. They gotta look different.
Yeah.
You gotta form a something in people's heads that
I mean,
just doesn't
just
look
just private
like that.
Offices anyway. Who has their
private
own office
offices
anymore?
Are an absolute nonsense. Yeah. I just can't understand them in any way. No. So yes, let's get rid of all the private offices and
abolish the offices.
Yeah, they can go.
And what advice would you give to aspiring strategists looking to get into advertising?
I think try and find people. I tend to think that the way to get in is to try and have a look at work that you think is great.
Yeah.
Find out who made it. And then find the people who really made it. Yeah. Like who was the planner, who was the strategist, and see if you can get to talk to them. I also think, you know, the resources like the APG and stuff like that are just, I mean, How Not to Plan is the best book to read by a country mile because it's so practical. But I think find people. I mean, in the end, I got into advertising in the beginning through people. I found people and I sort of carried on.
Yeah. And I guess in this world, would that be sort of communities online? Would that be...
Yeah, I mean, there are all sorts of communities out there. There are loads of planning meetups, which I think are really, really good. But I think, try and find someone who you have some, you know, you can find common ground. I love it when planners email me or strategists email me and say, oh, can we meet or can we have a coffee or can I pick your brains? I always try, I hope I do, and say yes. But I think, trying to find someone who can help you, who's thinking that you think, oh, yeah, that's interesting. I can sort of see what they've done there. Or they seem like a sort of interesting and interested person.
Yeah.
I think can be really, really helpful. Cool. So, yeah, it's a really people-ish business.
Yeah.
In that I think, you've got to... I do think you sort of have to try and find your people in the end.
Yeah.
And your people are, I mean, people who sort of think in maybe think in ways that you can understand or that you like, or that you think I can add to the way, something to the way they're thinking.
Yeah.
But yeah, I think people who look interesting to you, yeah, probably. Yeah.
Nice. And it's interesting as well, as we mentioned before, advertising strategy is a very sort of white, privileged, dominated industry.
Terrible.
I'm kind of on a bit of a mission to understand how agencies, the small steps agencies can take to make it more accessible.
Yeah.
Within strategy specifically, what do you think those steps need to look like?
I think they need to look like ways in that really, I mean, let's be really honest, come from state schools and...
Yeah, because there's wicked organisations. There's Brixton Finishing School.
There's loads of good stuff.
Yeah.
But I think also, I mean, you know, in the old days, you used to go out to universities and talk to people. I certainly did it at BBH, yeah. I think, again. I can't remember where we went. But I think you have to get to schools, probably, school level, A level and before... and talk about the fact that it even exists.
Yeah.
But also I think you have to target places. So I do think you have to target regionality. So I think VCCP are in Stoke and places like that. And various agencies are setting up in Manchester. But I think you kind of have to get out there and do as much as you can to talk to people and get bring them in. A lot of places now have sort of open source training. But I think there's a step before that that is really sort of educating people about the fact that advertising exists and you might be able to do something
in it. Strategy?
What you actually do. Yeah. I mean, it's still a thing that some people struggle with, like my mum and dad. So, you know, it's fair enough. But I do think if you can, I think you've got to be out there talking to people in one way or another.
Nice. Yeah. And what do you think, again, very big question, but what do you think the future of advertising or strategy looks like, whether that's under the influence of AI, whether that's from a D&I perspective?
Well, I don't worry about AI at all. I mean, I think it's a great thing. I think we'll do extraordinary things. I still think it's one of those brilliant sort of pieces of incredible technology that is still very much in its infancy and is finding its way. And what I mean by that is, it's finding where it's most useful.
Yeah.
I don't feel threatened by it in advertising in any way, because I think its shortcomings are the ones that are most important in advertising anyway. And by that,
I mean...
What does
it look like? What are we using AI for in advertising?
I think most sensibly, we're using it for everything that can be automated helpfully. Yeah. And that's,
concepting, creative, is that?
I think less so creative because I think it's been proven that what happens is you don't get brilliant ideas from it. But I think it can be used to do a lot of the things that are very time consuming and difficult. So one of the things I love it being used for is when you're generating, for example, storyboards for something or you're making a version of something, when you have an idea, it's brilliant doing that, because actually you can construct brilliant, brilliant versions of the idea in a much easier way than you could before. It was very time consuming, you know, involving all sorts of illustrators and whatever. And I think in terms of collecting data, it can be very useful. In terms of research, it can be useful. I think the problems come when people say, oh yeah, actually you can use it to create a piece of communication, or you can use it to create. It's a brilliant thing, I think, to show automated responses and learned responses to things. That's what it is effectively, is learning and using that learning. And so there's loads of ways it can be applied. So I'm not worried about that. But I think the future of communications is still as much, if not more, the same as it was, which is all about brilliant creative ideas. Long live creativity. Yes.
And on that note, we're running out of time, but Sophie, thank you so much for coming.
Thank you for having me. I really enjoyed it. Sorry,
that's
probably
I could
yap for
another 3 hours, to be honest. Thank you.
Thank you.